From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Senate Republicans need almost every GOP vote to pass President Trump's tax cut plan. So what must they have been thinking watching this morning's blistering war of words between the president and Tennessee Senator Bob Corker ahead of a lunch Trump will have with Republican senators on Capitol Hill this afternoon to push for unity, of all things? This round in their ongoing fight appeared to start when Corker, on NBC's Today Show, called on Trump to step aside on tax reform and let congressional Republicans take the lead on tax cuts.
That's the best way for us to have success. But I think it's fine for him to come over. I do look at these things as more of a, you know, photo op. They're not really about substance, but, more power to him.
Well, then Trump took to Twitter to say Corker, who is retiring, was behind the bad Iran deal and couldn't get elected dog catcher. Corker fired back on CNN, calling Trump an utterly untruthful president and more, and so it went.
Let's bring in our political strategist for the week. Matt Mikowiak is a Republican strategist based in Austin, Texas. Hi there, Matt.
Hey there.
And Angela Rye, Democratic strategist who joins us from Los Angeles today. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
All right, so let's hear a little bit more of what Senator Corker had to say, because CNN caught up with him in the halls of the Senate after the president's dog catcher tweet. So let's listen to what Corker said.
I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does.
Matt, let's start with you. What exactly is going on here, and how much could it have an impact on Republican efforts to reform the tax code?
Yeah, it's a good question on the tax code piece. Corker has expressed concern about the effect on the deficit, and he's made some pretty stark comments about that, about his ability to support the tax reform plan. As we remember from the Obamacare debacle, you can only lose two Republican senators and still get 50 plus the vice president to pass it using the reconciliation procedure. So if you lose Corker, you can only lose one other Republican senator and still pass it. Corker's, truly a unique figure right now because he's not running for re-election, so he's totally untethered to his electorate. He's free to do and say what he wants, but he's also powerful. And usually retiring members are not powerful, but he is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman. And so given that the decertification of the Iran deal has a 60-day deadline, he's in the middle of that. Obviously, he's in the middle of the North Korea situation, working with the State Department on a range of issues. So he's a influential member. He's very unique. He obviously feels free to speak his mind right now, and he has a pretty big problem with the president. I don't really understand what he's trying to achieve with it from a strategy standpoint. I understand he's frustrated. I understand the president's been attacking him, and he doesn't like that. I don't really understand what he's trying to achieve.
Well, but he's not alone. There's another Republican, yeah, Pennsylvania Congressman Charlie Dent, who told the New York Times that Trump can shift on a dime and has many unformed policy positions, promises more than he can deliver. Republican Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi was asked on CNN this morning where the president stands on tax cuts. Let's listen.
I think it's important that we not negotiate the details in public through the media. But I think that the bones, the outline of the tax cuts are there. We want to cut the corporate rate because we want to be competitive internationally.
So you have that don't negotiate in public. But Angela, we had President Trump yesterday tweeting out people will keep their 401k tax deductible money. This torpedoed any hopes that the Republican deficit hawks had of lessening the amount of money that people could sock away on these retirement plans tax-free. Republicans were hoping to use that to offset the deficit expected from the president cuts. So the president is undermining what the Republicans are trying to do.
That's not new. He's done that throughout. I think Matt just referenced the ACA, but I would call that the Trump Care debacle, the inability of the Republican Party to repeal or replace Obamacare and trying to do something different with Trump Care. So once again, the president is not only negotiating policy that he doesn't fully understand in the public, but also trying to do it in 140 characters or less, which I'm sure his his staff would not recommend. So for senators and members of the House of Representatives to go forward and do the same thing, I think they understand that that's the only way to get their commander-in-chief's attention. That is the only thing he understands is public pressure, and that is why he continues to attack people who seem to have a voice and a bully pulpit on the outside. No pun intended there. I know Melania started a new campaign that she should have started at home. But nonetheless, I think that it's something that he understands very well. That's public pressure.
You're talking about Melania Trump's, the First Lady's bullying campaign, which she started this week. Hey, by the way, Matt, what do you think of that? I mean, is there a disconnect there? You've got the First Lady, you know, visiting school children, very excited to see her. They took their selfies with her. But she's starting a cyberbullying campaign as her husband bullies people on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, look, I never want to get in the middle of a marriage. Every marriage is unique, and as someone who is married, I respect that. What I would say is that, you know, Melania, I think, has been trying to develop her platform, and in fact, in the last week or so, has become, I think, more clear on exactly what all she's going to be doing. I think privately she probably does push back on certain things that her husband says and does, but look, cyberbullying is a problem whether President Trump uses Twitter to try to motivate legislators or not. And so I think it's all to the good that she's doing it. I understand that a lot of people want to try to use that issue against her and against the president, and I understand why.
I want to play a little bit of tape here from House Speaker Paul Ryan, him commenting on the feud between Senator Corker and President Trump. And he says it will not affect the GOP's efforts on its tax plan.
At the end of the day, I know Bob well. Bob's going to vote for Tennessee, he's going to vote for America, he's going to vote for tax reform because he knows it's in the best interest of Americans. So put this Twitter dispute aside. The fact is we have a historic chance of actually fixing this tax code, giving people pay raises.
So it's interesting that the speaker calls it a Twitter dispute. And I want to ask both of you, and I'll just start with you, Matt, because Bob Corker, we played that tape a little earlier. He said the president is debasing himself and debasing America by using the language that he uses on social media. I mean, that's a serious charge. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it is a serious charge. And, you know, Corker, as I said before, is you know, freed up and, you know, unrestrained right now in a way that most elected officials are not.
I guess let me ask you more directly.
Sure.
Is he right?
Well, look, I think the president uses language in ways that are sometimes not helpful, certainly in ways that make the presidency appear different, both domestically and internationally, than it has in the past. Look, Trump's unorthodox. There's good and there's bad with that. There's good in the sense that it's a different approach. It's an outside approach. He's, you know, very active. He's very motivated to do things quickly. He's very motivated to use executive approaches, things like that. But look, I'm not a fan of his use of Twitter. I'm just not. I think that a lot of these things are better discussed in private. They're better negotiated in private. I think that's a big part of why Senate Republicans are so frustrated, is that they don't feel like they can work with him as a partner in the White House because they never know what he's going to tweet the next morning. But the challenge, you know, for Senate Republicans is we're 10 months into the administration and they've done nothing of consequence besides confirm a Supreme Court justice on a party line vote. And so I don't have a ton of sort of sympathy for Senate Republicans right now. They need to pass tax reform before the end of the year. They need to take up the Iran deal within the 60-day window that they have. They have to pass the spending bill by the end of the year. They're working towards a compromise on DACA. I mean, there's a range of issues. They need to get moving. They need to do about 2 years of work in 6 weeks.
I just want to give Angela a chance to respond to that. My question about Corker saying the president's debasing America.
Well, I think we all know where I stand on this. I think that, you know, many of the president's actions demonstrate that he's unqualified, and he continues to demonstrate that he doesn't know how to do things that are not called for. And I think if we just took a moment to reflect on if Barack Hussein Obama had done any of what Donald Trump does on Twitter, there would be an outrage, an uproar, and an upheaval at the, you know, Republican level of Congress and on the state legislative levels. It is ridiculous. And at some point, you would think that people would stop backpedaling and trying to make excuses for these actions. He's irresponsible. And there are vast and huge consequences for that. Bob Corker talked about the president quite literally being able to start a war on Twitter. Those things are real. And I don't think that we're doing any of ourselves any favors by saying, calling it exactly what it is and calling the president out for what he continues to do, which is largely irresponsible. And it's not setting a good precedent for what kids should be doing, for what adults should be doing. Many of us, if we engage in this behavior at work, would lose our jobs. So we need to call it for what it is.
Well, Matt Mikowiak, what about that? And this week in particular, there was another Twitter feud, the one that Trump kept alive yesterday with his fight with the Gold Star widow, Maisha Johnson. This is a president seeming, well, he has said, he during the campaign, he said, I've never said I'm sorry. Fanning the flames of this.
Yeah, I think, look, you know, Donald Trump as an individual, like all of us, has different strengths and weaknesses. And one of his weaknesses clearly is a lack of empathy for others. You know, we've never seen a president of the United States engage in a back and forth with a Gold Star family. We just never seen it. And my guess is we'll never see it again whenever the Trump presidency ends. In this case, though, you know, this was a very unique circumstance because you had General Kelly, you know, basically vouch for Trump's side of it.
Well, but with the wrong information. I mean, I'm going to have to end it at that.
That was wrong information about one aspect of the FBI dedication, not about the call itself. But either way, my point is, it was a very unfortunate chapter, and there were no winners in that, clearly.
Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist, Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, and it's only midweek. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
It's been 2 months since Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, and city officials say that as many as 126,000 homes were severely impacted by flooding. But could some of those homes have been spared? Well, one answer to prevent flooding is home elevation, and some homeowners are pursuing that option. But Allison Lee from Houston Public Media found out that the way up isn't always straightforward.
Jennifer and Randy Claridge have been through a lot.
It is really hard. It feels constant, and you know, yes, we lost everything that we owned, all of that stuff again.
Jennifer says their home in the Meyerland section of Houston has flooded every year since 2015, and they've been navigating the FEMA process to elevate their home out of harm's way ever since.
We're just waiting, and we can't move back in here until this thing is lifted. And secondly, yes, we're having to advocate, having to call, having to make those calls. But most of it is just trying to keep up with everything that has to get done in a day, adjusters and FEMA and, you know, where is the grant?
The Claridges finally heard they were approved for their elevation grant. But it was too late, just days before Hurricane Harvey hit. But right around the corner, workers are putting the finishing touches on a home they did elevate just one day before Harvey.
I definitely have a mixed swirl of emotions of I'm ecstatic that we beat the flood. That's amazing. But, I mean, my heart aches for my entire community. We didn't flood personally, but everyone I know flooded.
Homeowner Drew Sheffman says he couldn't wait for FEMA to approve his grant. He paid for the elevation himself.
There's no way. It takes too long, too much red tape, too much paperwork. That was, like, whatever number. I was, like, 87th on the list to be lifted. So I would have definitely been with everyone else.
Construction workers got Sheffman's house 5 feet off the ground before Harvey. Now they're taking it up to the 10-foot elevation mark. That would be a first in Meyerland, if not the city of Houston.
Right now, we've got 7 city of Houston jobs sponsored by FEMA, and then 2 private jobs going on.
Sheffman's contractor, Philip Contreras, is one of a handful of builders in Houston who are qualified to do private and FEMA grant lifts.
But almost anything we touch could be lifted. Elevating houses have been going on for years. I mean, they elevated all of Galveston in the 1900s. It's just the process of have developed more and more over time.
Contreras says on average it takes about 4 to 5 months to elevate a home, and it does come at a price.
Up to about 5 foot. It runs about $75 a square foot. On high raises, it could range anywhere from $110 to $130. And it really is going to depend on what the people want. You know, some people may want just basic code with basic stairs to get in their home.
It would cost about $150,000 to elevate a 2,000 square foot home 5 feet, bare minimum. But some people can't settle for the bare minimum because of things like homeowners association requirements. But
The purpose of these grants is to get the homes out of harm's way, to get them high and dry. It's not necessarily to beautify them.
Jamila Johnson is the managing engineer for the City of Houston's Floodplain Management Office.
It may not be acceptable to your homeowners association that you have a 5-foot platform with wooden stairs as your front porch now. It may not be acceptable to you or your HOA that your house is now up on concrete block columns instead of sitting on the ground like all your other neighbors' homes. So all of those types of costs are left for the homeowner to deal with.
Johnson says the construction costs that the FEMA grants don't cover could get in the tens of thousands of dollars. And she says funding for these types of programs is not where it should be.
I think that it was not the best decision from FEMA to have such a low funding level for these very needed programs that are oversubscribed every year. Houston would have liked to elevate 150 homes in 2016, but instead we only got funding for 40.
The Claridges were lucky enough to be one of those 40 homes.
People's like, oh, well, you know, it's Meyerland, it floods. Why don't you just move out of there and get out? And my thing is, we didn't come to this problem. When Meyerland was built, it was not in the floodplain. That problem is coming to us. We did not go to that problem. So if you want to bulldoze down the west side of Houston and say they shouldn't be doing the development the way they're doing it, let's have that discussion. But don't just have the knee-jerk reaction and saying, well, you shouldn't have been there.
Randy Claridge says his neighborhood should not be condemned just because it's flood prone.
This was a good place. This is a good place. And we're fighting hard to protect it and to keep it for the future generations. It's worth fighting for. We weren't looking for this fight, but we're in it.
And with nearly 80 FEMA elevation grants still pending in the Houston area, a lot of people are in this fight with them. For Here and Now, I'm Allison Lee in Houston.
And just a couple of weeks after Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma arrived. The storm hit the Florida Keys hard, and getting the tourism industry back up and running is one of the top priorities there. The Tourist Development Council, based in Key West, has already launched a $1 million ad campaign. So how's the effort being received? Let's check in with WLRN's Nancy Klingener. She lives in Key West. And Nancy, it's good to talk with you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, how are things? Because the last time we checked in with you was right after the storm and there was no power, et cetera. So how are things now?
Things are a lot better in Key West, and they got better very quickly here in Key West, for sure. Yeah, life feels pretty normal down here, or what passes for normal down here.
But I've been hearing that there may be kind of a split existence there in the Keys overall.
Yeah, it really depends where you are in the Keys, what your situation is right now. In the lower Keys, the area where Hurricane Irma's eye passed over, they took a really, really hard hit, of course, a Category 4 hurricane hitting you directly. And a lot of people there are still dealing with the daily impacts of the storm, while people in Key West are going about their lives pretty normally and trying to get back to business.
Okay, so really different experiences then. But I understand that this week there's the biggest tourism event of the year in the Keys going on.
That's right, and that's in Key West, Fantasy Fest. It's a 10-day sort of festival of costume parties and parades and lots of different events. It normally brings tens of thousands of visitors, fills every hotel room, you know, in the Keys, in the lower Keys, even all the way up to Marathon in the middle Keys. And that's underway in Key West right now.
Okay. Well, you actually spoke with someone who's at Fantasy Fest. Her name is Carol Christman, and she lives in Key West. And she told you that she's happy that the community is throwing this big party to bring in the visitors.
This is what we do. You know, we bounce back. And it's like professional football players. When there's a disaster or something, they come in, they play the game. We're the same thing. We're playing the game. We're going in and we're having some fun.
Having some fun. But obviously, tourism is very important to the Keys. How much is it bouncing back?
It's bouncing back quite a bit here in Key West, for sure, because we have the hotel rooms available. Other areas of the Keys, some of the resorts, even as far up as Isla Mirada in the upper Keys, are still cleaning up. They're still not reopened. And a lot of the advertising that's going on now is really to salvage the season. Our high tourist season takes place between Christmas and Easter roughly every year when the weather's really nice here. And the idea is to make sure that people who are making their plans for later this year in the winter and spring still consider the Keys.
Yeah. You know, I can imagine that people have very different opinions about how much they want tourists around right now, since, as you said earlier, parts of the Keys are still trying to recover. Because you also talked to Jim Ensminger. He is of Big Pine Key, and he told you tourists are driving around and gawking, and he'd rather have some of the resources that are being used to help attract tourists to Key West. He wants those resources to help residents rebuild instead.
We've had buses going through and taking pictures. People should come first. The residents should come first. Then the tourists.
So, Nancy, tell us more about what you're hearing from residents in places like Big Pine Key.
Yeah, that's a pretty common sentiment, and you can understand why. First of all, you don't want to become a sort of disaster tourist attraction. You know, this is your home. These are your belongings that are out on the street. And also, there's just the idea of having the Keys as a whole portrayed with beautiful pictures and saying, come on back, everything's great, when in fact everything is not great. You're dealing every single day with the impacts of a disaster and your entire life has been upended.
Yeah. So it sounds like some people feel like they haven't been getting enough assistance from state and federal officials. But as we move forward, I mean, what are the most important long-term needs that still need to be met in the Keys?
Housing is absolutely the critical need, and that was clear immediately after the storm when they saw what the effects were, especially in the Lower Keys and especially on the housing that had been sort of the base level of affordable housing, or what passes for affordable housing here in the Keys. We already had an affordable housing crisis here because we're an expensive resort area with a service industry economy. And mobile homes and boats, which people lived aboard because that was an affordable option, took the hardest hit from the storm. So figuring out where people can live, both in the interim while they rebuild and for the long term, is absolutely the biggest challenge the Keys are facing right now.
Yeah. Well, that's WLRN's Nancy Klingener in Key West talking to us about ongoing recovery efforts following Hurricane Irma. Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
The teams that open baseball's World Series in Los Angeles tonight, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Houston Astros, are the first in 47 years to each have won more than 100 games in the regular season. So, yeah, they're good. And the temperature at game time in L.A. could approach 100 degrees as Southern California bakes in heat wave. So this could be a sizzling series. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, talk about the heat. Will that play a role?
Yeah, well, the heat that I'm worried about, or that the Astros should be worried about, will come from the arm of Clayton Kershaw, Dodgers starter, and the opposite number, Dallas Keuchel, on the mound for Houston. And then Houston signed Justin Verlander with a few months to go in the season. He'll be pitching game two. So I just mentioned three pitchers. Two are almost certainly going to the Hall of Fame. Certainly one of the reasons why both of these teams have the win totals that you accounted for. You know, this I'm really glad that these two teams made the World Series, and Cleveland would have been a fine contributor too, because they were 100 win teams. But so often we have teams squeak into the postseason and it's a nice magical run, but to reward season long excellence, I mean, that's why the World Series exists, I think.
No, I think you're right. And this sounds like it's going to be a good one. And people might be saying, aren't they always? No, they're not. So,
nope.
Yeah. So is the pressure on the Dodgers, do you think? They haven't won a World Series title since 1988.
Well, let's contrast that with the Astros, which would be a big never.
Right. Nothing in the franchise's 56-year history. So,
right,
yeah.
Since they started as the Houston Colt 45s. So I would say that certainly Dodger fans feel it, and this is a team that came into the season as the odds-on favorite, and they were gangbusters from the get-go. The Dodgers have just an excellent team, great pitching and great bullpen. And so if they lose, their fans could say, what a great team. I can't believe we lost. The thing is, you're playing someone else, and the Astros lineup, offensively, the Astros have no flaws in their lineup. If there's one portion of this whole matchup where one team has a flaw, it's the Astros bullpen. Their relief pitchers are bad. So what their manager, A.J. Hinch, has done, something brilliant, he's stopped using them. He's now using starters in relief, and that's working out for them. I don't know if it'll work out over 7 games, but so far that seems to be a stopgap solution.
Well, Houston also has a little something extra they're playing for. Their city still recovering from Harvey. People have drawn parallels to Boston after the bombing, you know, the Red Sox. There is impetus there.
And it certainly has brought the city together in not, you know, frankly, not a great professional sports town. They were so bad for so long that they cultivated talent. And now they have young players like Carlos Correa, their shortstop, who's along with the Dodgers shortstop, Seager, the future of baseball. And Jose Altuve, the second baseman on the Astros, shortest guy in baseball, should win the AL MVP award. There's a lot to root for the city of Houston with their team.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, pick a winner. No, yes.
You know, I'll do it. I'll say the Dodgers in 6, but I think that's probably a little bit hedging. You know, I looked at the statistical analysis, and they're saying the Dodgers are like a 52-55% chance of winning. I note that Las Vegas thinks there are a little bit better odds than that. Maybe there's value if you want to go to Las Vegas and bet the Astros. That is what I am advocating you do, Rob.
Oh, and you just gave the Astros even more incentive to win. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist. Slate.com. It'll be a great either 5 or 9 days.
Yeah, I hope so.
Dwight Garner is a book critic for the New York Times. He also writes the American Beauties column. It celebrates books that catch his eye, even if in some cases the authors and the books themselves are long gone. Well, one recent column caught our eye. Here's how it opens. The late Stanley Elkin's third novel, The Dick Gibson Show, is not improving to read. Its heart is not in the right place. It squeezes the blackheads behind the ears of your imagination. It's a Diane Arbus walk on the unreconciled side. It's among the most powerful and funny American novels I know. Okay, we'll bite. And Dwight Garner joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
Oh, it's good to talk to you again. We love this column and this one in particular. The book was Elkin's third novel. It's about a fictitious overnight radio host in the decades after World War II. Tell us more. Who's this fictitious host?
Well, Dick Gibson. It's called The Dick Gibson Show, and it's not his real name. I mean, sometimes this fellow goes by Tex Ellery or Marshall Main or Harold Hardy, and we never really learn his real name. And in a way, that's Elkin's point. You go on the radio, and you sort of can become a new person. You can reinvent yourself.
Well, as you write, this Dick Gibson in this late night, you know, after midnight shift, when things are spoken over the cooling and ticking airwaves, talks about what?
Well, really everything. I mean, in a way, having a late night radio show and telling the story of this novel through the different voices of the people who come on Dick Gibson's show is just a brilliant conceit for a novel because it allows Elkin just to inhabit one voice after another. And as the novel goes on, the voices get stranger and stranger and the night grows long and there may or may not be a gun under the table. And, mm-hmm. you know, the stories just get very odd.
You read it in college. Now you say it probably wouldn't be assigned. It would require more trigger warnings than a Roy Rogers movie, because there are stories of violence against women, old men fiddling with young men in movie theaters, belches of casual racism, cruelty and abandonment and distress peek from beneath every curtain. It doesn't sound like a nice book, so why is it such a compelling book?
Well, in a way, that's why it's so compelling. I mean, Elkin just didn't have as many filters as many other writers did. And you get the sense reading him that he is sort of closer to the grain than a lot of other writers. He is not trying to put a polite face on anything in this world. And the kind of stuff that his characters say, you get the sense that he's speaking from a dark place, but from a real place.
Mm, yeah, you can scan it for wordplay, you write, which Elkin's wordplay often reads like Shakespeare by way of Saul Bellow. Tell us more about Elkin's.
Well, first of all, let me just say, I mean, Elkins was a word guy. I mean, a lot of writers write brilliant onrushing plots. Elkin just tried to flood the page. Every sentence is just this quasi-work of genius, and he just sort of never wastes a word. Elkin is an interesting man. He was born in St. Louis in 1930. For most of his adult life, he had multiple sclerosis, and he wrote about that in one of his novels, it sort of gave him this larger, I think, sense of humanity. There's a sense of darkness, a sense of understanding the kind of things people have to overcome.
Mm. He lived 1930 to 1995. The contents of his novel leave you a bit sick, you write. His talent leaves you wasted, too. This book is a landslide of language, and it's unfair somehow that so many gifts were bestowed on one writer. But may we say, the same is often true of you, Dwight Garner. some of your sentences here are just lovely. You write of Dick Gibson, again, this late-night host. Late at night, the ids of his callers and guests flash like dorsal fins. He traps into what he calls the range of the strange. Just as someone who's a book critic, and you're now sharing with us these somewhat lost books, this one we found used copies of, does it make you, does it inspire you to write better?
I mean, I think it does. I mean, I think that no one would try to write like Stanley Elkin because he's a genius, you know. And there are times when it's funny, you can read a book critic writing about a writer. There's some writers who have very dynamic styles, you know, a John Updike or a Tom Wolfe. And you'll sometimes see a critic try to sort of mimic their style and in the doing take a pratfall because they're not easily imitated. But I do think that reading Stanley Elkin gets your juices flowing. And I recommend him to any would-be creative writer. Any would-be critic, as a matter of fact.
Okay, so what else should we be reading? His books.
Well, I mean, this is a great place to start, particularly that it gets to show. You should know it if you're in radio or even if you're a podcaster. It's just one of these landmark books about a field.
I want to stop you there because you point out these were in the decades after World War II. There's still, you can still drive around parts, you know, most of the country and hear after midnight these wonderful AM, you know, characters. But this was a unique time that sort of, again, he wrote this in 1971. It's very prescient. I mean, it kind of foresaw the internet and, you know, online blogging and a lot of the partisan voices that we're hearing now.
He did. And there's this great moment in the novel in which he starts to think what will happen when you combine his voice over the radio with his callers phoning in over the telephone. And he comes to see the telephone as it's a kind of pre-internet. I mean, he didn't know the internet at this time. But, you know, what one voice can do at home in their own living room, calling into a talk show, the kind of power that voice could have getting out over the airwaves.
You write, Elkin considers how the telephone can make every home in America its own potential broadcasting station and every American his own potential star. But what else should we read of Elkin?
Well, his novel, The Franchiser, from 1976, is about this fellow who just collects franchises. I mean, you know, famous companies. And there's something all-American in the way that he wants to align himself with the great American brands. And it's also, like the Dick Gibson show, very dark and very strange. And another book of his is called The Magic Kingdom from 1985, about a man who takes some terminally ill kids to Disney World for a final trip. And, of course, Elkin being Elkin, you know, there's more dark meditations on illness and death than you would expect from a book that largely takes place at the Magic Kingdom.
Okay, so duly noted. That's Dwight Garner. He writes the American Beauties column in the New York Times, pointing out books that we should be noticing. We'll link you to his column about Stanley Elkin's third novel, The Dick Gibson Show. It's from 1971. I can't wait to read it. Dwight, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
To Tampa, Florida now, and a real-life frightening story. Three people shot to death in the past 2 weeks in the blue-collar but gentrifying Seminole Heights neighborhood. Police are not saying serial killer, but residents are alarmed. 400 gathered last night. Here's Tampa Police Chief Brian Dugan.
This pains me to tell you that if you're out there walking alone, that you're either a suspect or a potential victim.
Howard Altman is with the Tampa Bay Times. Howard, what connects these three victims?
What's making police think that there's a connection here is the proximity and the timing. There have been three murders within about a 10-day span, all within a half a mile, all along one of the bus routes in the city. So that's what the police are keying in on. The victims, that's what's making this vexing, is that the victims have no apparent commonality and there's nothing in their behavior that would have led them to get into a dangerous situation.
Right.
Two of the victims knew each other tangentially at one of the local high schools, but beyond that, there's no connection, and that's what has police puzzled.
Okay, well, and we know that they're out handing out light bulbs for people to screw in their porches, and they're replacing street lamps. The mayor also spoke last night, used some very graphic language and saying we're going to get this, you know, fill-in-the-blank guy. But they don't know if it's one or more than one.
The chief last night made it clear that they don't know if this person is white or black, a man, a woman, and he even, you know, suggests maybe it's two stepbrothers in, you know, their mother's house that are doing this. So they really have no clue. They released a video that showed somebody walking around in the neighborhood, and they don't know that this is connected. They just know that the person was out there at the approximate time of one of the homicides. People are very, very worried. They're scared. They have no answers. Businesses are down. I talked to some folks at the Fat Boy convenience store last night, and they said that they've had to take their own pay cuts. They've had to tell suppliers to supply less because there are a lot of their businesses at night, and people are kind of hunkering down.
Well, no kidding. I mean, the victims were either riding some of the buses or on the bus line. They were shot on the streets, and people have been told, don't go out, but Halloween's coming.
The police is really encouraging people to turn on their lights and to be out and to show a presence. And he said last night that Halloween should go on as expected. I talked to one gentleman who usually brings his grandchildren there because they know the neighborhood. They get a lot more candy. And he said not until they catch the killer. He's not bringing his grandchildren, 6 and 3, into that neighborhood. And that's going to be interesting to see what happens, whether people are actually out on the streets when there's, you know, this killer out there. Costumes can be certainly problematic.
Mm, just terrible. And thanks for clarifying. The police chief said don't go out alone, but you're saying they want people to, you know, have a vigorous presence on the streets. Howard Altman of the Tampa Bay Times, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
If you live in any number of American cities, you might already be occasionally zipping down or zipping around town, I should say, on a shared bike, one that you pick up at a station and rent for a period of time and then return to another station. Bike sharing systems have been popular in the U.S. for about a decade now, but they're on the verge of a significant expansion, in part thanks to technology. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is Senior Transportation Editor at Recode. Hi there, Johanna.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great. So bike sharing programs have been around for a while now, but it seems as if companies are looking to grow with dockless programs. So how would that work?
Yeah, so dockless programs work a lot like the bike sharing system of today, except you don't actually have to find a station to park your bike back in because the technology in the bike now, you can essentially unlock and lock the bike by scanning a QR code. So theoretically, you can leave this essentially anywhere, but obviously cities are a little bit concerned with bikes sort of stacking up and crowding parts of the public space.
Yeah. So, but tell me a little bit more. Unlock and lock the bike? Like, is there some sort of clamp around the wheel that is released? Okay.
Yeah. So it's the back wheel, and then when you scan the QR code using whichever company's app it is, the back wheel locks again.
Okay. And so what are companies in betting on here? I mean, why do they think they could be successful or even more successful, given that we already have, in a lot of cities, so many other currently well-functioning bike-sharing programs?
Definitely. Well, for one, the biggest complaint about the existing bike sharing system is that, you know, there really isn't a lot of access to it in places outside of major cities. And a part of that is because there is the costs and investment in the infrastructure, the stations themselves. In a lot of cities, the city itself is funding those stations. In New York, the company that's running City Bike, Motivate, actually pays for it itself. However, you still obviously have to come up with the money and then rent that parking space or part of that public space from the city. So with dockless biking, you don't need a physical station anywhere. So the idea is, and their pitch is, that they can expand fairly quickly. And so the parts of Brooklyn that City Bike may not serve today can be easily served by a dockless bike sharing company simply by placing a few bikes in that neighborhood.
I see. Now, are there other sort of tech infrastructure needs, though, that the system would have to have? Because obviously you'd have to have enough broadband or internet connections to be sure to keep track of all the bikes and have all the a critical mass of users, things like that.
Definitely. So all of the bikes are GPS enabled. Yeah. And so, you know, the company is able to keep track of it, which helps with things like making sure that there are enough bikes in places of higher demand, or even just spreading it out so that more people can have access to that bike. So the bikes have GPS capabilities. More and more of these bike companies are introducing electric bikes as well. And so we're going to continue to see that technology advance within the bikes.
Yeah, so it seems that you were saying earlier that you didn't want all the bikes. One wouldn't want them to all end up in certain areas. So I imagine every once in a while, maybe a company would have to go around and kind of redistribute where the bikes are. But you've mentioned that there's a bit of a war going on between companies. I mean, how competitive is the market right now?
Yeah, so this is a fairly competitive market across the globe, but it's really early on in the U.S. And yet, you know, companies like Lime Bike, which launched earlier this year, is already in 14 markets. That paired with the competition against the existing player, which is Motivate and a few other players that operate City Bike in New York, Ford Go Bike in San Francisco, and so on and so forth, that the dockless bike sharing companies are now competing against this existing player, which has exclusive contracts in a lot of cities. Add to that, there are two or three Chinese players, which they've seen incredible success across China. They've now launched in the U.S., and they have upwards of $900 million in funding. And so the space is definitely heating up a lot, and investors are starting to pour a lot of a significant sum of money into the space.
Okay. So on the one hand, having more people ride bikes seems really great, right? It's more energy efficient. You're not going around in a polluting car. Better for your health, better for the environment. Lots of good things about bike riding. But I don't know. I just look around in the streets right around our studio, and I see lots of people riding without helmets and riding in places that really it's mostly for cars because the number of bikes on the road has been growing so much. So, I mean, are certain city governments perhaps wary about they don't necessarily have the infrastructure to support all these new temporary cyclists?
Definitely. And the main problem that the cities have is, as we talked about before, where people are going to put their bikes. Right now, the impetus is kind of on the user, the rider, to make sure that they put their bike in a responsible place so it's not in the way, it's not taking up a ton of space. So that's one concern. But the other concern, as you said, is do they have the infrastructure to see this increased usage of bike sharing companies? And these bike sharing companies, a big part of their pitch to cities is that because their bikes are GPS enabled and are connected, they're able to share with them anonymized trip data to show where they might need to invest in creating new bike lanes, for instance.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully then the cities and states would have money to do that as well. But Johanna Buya, senior editor at Recode, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And wear your helmets, everyone. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy's back tomorrow.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.